Karen has a roving mic if anyone has any questions.
Sorry, not from here, from Brazil. And one of the most important things that I know that I mentioned about the demographic change, that I'm a doctor, I'm a dentist, and I feel that it's like in Brazil, the developing countries, they have a really fast speed about the aging population. But like when you relate it to economical, it doesn't fit. When you see about developing countries, they most of the people are poor, and how they still just growing up.
I think in the short term there are, you know, there are societies with relatively robust growth. I mean, Philippines, for example, I think has a fertility rate of about 3.5. Singapore is about 1.9. Hong Kong, I think, is 1.5 or something like that. So there are, of course, countries that have relatively high robust fertility and a growing population, but they, of course, are exporting their population largely to the developed world. When I was living in Singapore, Singapore has 84,000 Filipino domestic workers looking after largely Chinese families, where you've got both the man and the husband, both the husband and the wife working in a typical Singaporean family, with a fertility rate of, you know, 1.8 or something, where the household is largely supported by Filipinos. So I think with the developed northern world, I'm arguing that with a declining fertility rate in northern Europe, much of Asia, etc., that these societies will have to depend either on technology or upon drawing their population, their working population in the short term from societies with high fertility rates. The only country that I know of that doesn't fit this pattern very well is America, which depends largely on Hispanic and other countries for supplying fertility. So, I mean, a lot of countries such as, you know, as we've seen in the recent political crisis, countries like Greece, France, Spain, Portugal have a large percentage of the young population that's unemployed. But, I mean, here I'd say, I think this is a short-term issue about this current crisis. And secondly, an issue about the decline of educational resources for young people over time in the last 40 or 50 years. People in this room of my generation, namely people over 60, largely had free education. I mean, I went through undergraduate and PhD education, came out in 1969 with no debts whatsoever, and went into academic employment. I'm now 66, I have two professorships, and I'm never going to retire. So, I mean, I think for young academics, aged people like me around make it hugely problematic for young people to find employment, for example, in the academic world. This is why I think people of my generation should be frozen.
Yeah, because one of the reasons why we're here is about the research is that one oral health needs assessment at Gerontology Hospital from Kings. And what hours of my study has been based on what I have studied, I have researched, is about the no research can explain about how it's going this fast speed from these developing countries. Because like they're against about these economical things that it would have more, and what's happened is?
Well, I don't know, I'm not a demographer, yeah. but I assume that the cure of some basic infantile diseases, the improvements in water supply and so on and so forth, has sustained an economic, sorry, a demographic growth in third world societies that were not there in the past. But I would say that countries like Congo, many African countries that are going to be war-torn for many years to come, where TB and other killer diseases like malaria are increasing, that this demographic will change in the immediate future because of the declining standard of living in most of these societies.
Yes, that's more or less what I wanted to talk about. I might be missing the point, but you're talking about work and being healthy, but that doesn't naturally assume a quality of life. There are people who are healthy and work who are actually quite fed up. And, you know, one of the good things about life is that it is going to come to an end. I mean, I'm not a pessimist here, But I think there are certain things that it may be that the next speaker is going to address it. But quality of life, choice, being able to do things that you want to do when you can't because you haven't got finances. You're talking about in this recession now. You haven't really addressed that at all. Maybe you don't want to. Maybe it's not in your brief. But I think it's important.
I don't think you get the irony of my argument. I'm saying that working forever is a... I'm sort of arguing that it's not necessarily the case that most people want to work forever. Indeed, through much of the 50s and 60s, the trade union movement was struggling desperately to give people the opportunity to retire with an adequate pension and a decent lifestyle. And I think that that is disappearing. Again, living in America, it seems to me that Britain is going through a process of Americanization where much of the benefits of the welfare state are being obviously eroded, and where the educational basis of Britain and indeed its healthcare are being privatised, which will mean only the very rich will be able to afford the privileges of an adequate education and health. And so I'm ironically saying that in the absence of migration and in the absence of a high fertility rate, I mean, the two choices are freeze the elderly or make them work forever, neither of which seem to me to be very, you know, nice prospects particularly.
Thank you very much for your lecture. I'm just a bit concerned that there was not a mention of the gender element in this. You actually said at one point in November, will this generation let go of your power and wealth? I'm just wondering what power and wealth for women, as you all know, are struggling to have enough money to retire, as people with a great deal of knowledge having worked beyond male and female retirement age in order to have enough money to retire, even though we don't know how long we're going to live. That the sum would have to pay to be frozen as well. I think it's really necessary if you're going to put these options to us that we have a gender perspective. Well, I'd be interested in other people's opinion and what you have to say about that. Thank you.
I'm sure you know there's plenty of sociological research on gender differences in old age, where it seems to be the case that if you take much of the American data, it's old men who end up in isolated urban post-family environments, and it's the women who largely stick with their children and their family connections. And so I think the prolongation of life for men is going to be much more problematic than it is for women, given the research that seems to suggest that it's men that become totally isolated in old age. There's a very famous study of isolated men in Chicago, for example, that found that they were dying in isolation without any support whatsoever, whereas largely women still retain some sort of familial connection. The issue about this longevity debate, I think, is that, I mean, it also implies that the family is going to change very fundamentally with cyclical marriage and with elderly people forming new relationships later on. So, I mean, I think the notion of life cycle, family and gender will change very, very radically with life extension in ways that we probably don't entirely know. I mean, the other issue that intrigues me, in America I run a centre on research on religion. I actually don't have a great deal to do with demography as such, but I'm sort of interested in the issues relating to religion and old age, because if the longevity project was successful, I can't frankly see that a theology of paradise and heaven is going to survive in societies in which most people are going to live beyond 120 years, for example. I mean, won't that make a kind of impact on the religious notions about a life cycle, for example? I mean, most religions I would argue are based upon what I call a theology of unhappiness. That is, that life is nasty, short and brutish. Well, if life becomes long but only at the end boring and unpleasant, I mean, won't we have a kind of change in religious attitudes towards life? And there again, that this might have some kind of gender implication.
It seems to me that you talk, despite the irony, has this notion of demographic doom, which we've sort of seen certainly throughout the sort of the post-war period. Originally, in the 60s and 70s, the concern was the world was going to become overpopulated, massive amounts of fertility, people produced massive amounts of statistics about the average number of children that were born to women, and so on and so forth. And what clearly was evident from that is that as women's education increased, the number of years in which young girls were at school, so fertility rates dropped. One of the other consequences of increased amount of education has been increasing amount of healthy life expectancy. And behind, if you like, both of these sort of scenarios of doom, whether it would be overpopulated or would be sort of overwhelmed and suffocated by a sort of surfeit of greyness, is the notion that somehow or other there are these sort of terrible things happening. But in some ways, what is more evident is the continual progression of a better quality of life as a result of more education, more income. Now, of course, this is not evenly distributed, but in some ways, longevity, rather than being problematic, can be seen as a mark of success. And it's the success of people being able to reach whatever we consider to be old age, because most of the figures on life expectancy, international figures, are really related to levels of infant and child mortality rather than to the very long. And secondly, that it is based on somehow or other the notion that it's all going to go to rack and ruin, which I think is, you know, probably existed since kind of humankind ever sort of contemplated society. But whether it has any sort of meaning beyond this sort of vague sort of moral doom, I suspect it hasn't. Whereas the social, economic, and technological developments have had real impacts upon people's lives. Whether it's about life expectancy of people with juvenile diabetes who are being kept alive as a result of that injections of insulin, and I guess the majority of whom would be quite glad to have been kept alive rather than dying as teenagers, and as a result of increases in education, which has led to both drops in fertility, and one side of that is therefore the aging populations.
I came to this session this afternoon assuming that Aubrey de Grey would give us this wonderfully utopian, positive, happy view of the future, and so I wanted to give you the most miserable, depressing and dystopian view of the future. Basically, I think the social sciences are dismal sciences. Whether it's economics or sociology doesn't seem to me to matter. When I often say to students, tell me what you think is the most important social change of the 20th century. And I think there are two. One is the technological changes in warfare, which killed more civilians and soldiers by the end of the 20th century than serving soldiers. And the second, I think, is the decline in fertility rates. And this seems to be across all religious groups. I mean, I'm sort of amazed, to be honest, that you know, you look at Islamic groups in Malaysia, their fertility rates are down below 2. Fertility rates throughout much of Asia and Europe are well below 2, etc. So, having moved from a kind of world in which fertility rates were around about 5 or 6, we're you know, towards the end of the last century, down to these figures. And I think Philippines, again, is one of the few societies that stands out in this respect. And then, I mean, my pessimistic view of that is that because they're exporting women to Singapore, Malaysia, the Middle East, and so on and so forth. I think the lady, I think, who sort of challenged me from the back of the room and saying, you don't talk about the quality of life, I think the issue is not so much about whether we're surviving over longer periods of time, and I think nobody in this room is going to deny that people are surviving over a longer period of time. The real question is, what is the quality of life they've got? and whether those lives are at all meaningful or fulfilling or whatever. It seems to me that the reduction in female fertility through much of Asia has only allowed women to enter into factory work in much of the economic zones of China. And if you read about the lives of these women working in factories, it's not clear to me that the quality of their lives has actually improved over their grandmothers who were living in Chinese villages and dying probably much younger, but probably in more fulfilling and rewarding circumstances. So, I mean, I think this is a controversial issue. I agree with you that I've presented a totally miserable view of the future. But I think that my miserable view of the future is borne out by medical sociology, which seems to me at the moment to suggest that people living beyond 75 years of age don't have a particularly good life, particularly in societies like America, where prioritised medicine is not available to the great majority of the population.
Young, who I started Grandparents Plus with, you know, have started these sort of organisations in our very late life. Michael was 86 and I was 70 when we started them. And I think one of the wonderful things about living longer, and if we have even not the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth ages, third, the third age and fourth age gets a bit miserable, but nevertheless you can overcome it. One of the wonderful things is seeing our children's children. And how wonderful to see our children's children's children, it would be. And they do liberate you. And I'm sort of always a bit puzzled, because all my children in your age, you know, baby boomers, and I'm sort of interested that you think you're going to resist the idea that you're going to be marginalised. Well, our problem is you, really, and your attitude to us. That's my main problem at the minute, is your attitude to us. And that sort of, you know, how miserable you make us if you won't talk about death with us, for example, you know, which is a sort of a taboo. So I'm just really here to say that I think that providing we can be glued together a bit better and have some sort of physical quality of life. And I do recommend swimming. I've been swimming for 34 years every morning. If you want to know why, I can get on the underwear. But I honestly think it could be very good. And I don't agree with you.
Peter Maslow was a close friend of mine. He used to say to me in his old age, Brian, old age is like this. It's like wearing Wellington boots, having rubber gloves and a plastic bag over your head. Yes, I mean, I think that's a good enough answer. I mean, Peter Lazarus thought that old age was miserable.
Thank you very much. It's very hard to know which side to come down on, pessimistic or optimistic, because there is such different evidence you pointed out in terms of access to care, inequalities of life expectancy, between genders, ethnicities, and so on. What concerns me, working quite a lot, trying to continue to make a contribution to society, but therefore justify the space I occupy and the resources I take up, is the chaos with which government, certainly in this country, is handling the difficulties that we have, both actual and projected. While waiting to hear your very interesting analysis, I lived through Metro, and once again, what do we find? Apparently one of the government's latest suggestions is to virtually compel local authorities to nudge older people who are over-occupying space because they live in homes with more than one bedroom where there's only two of them, to vacate those. And on the other side, of course, there's the policy, particularly in Europe, of making it mandatory to build progressively for ageing by having at least two bedrooms per living unit so that you can provide for care at home. These seem to be highly contradictory approaches and symptoms of the chaos. So whether you come down on the pessimistic side or the optimistic side, I think it depends very much upon the prism you hold up to present arrangements for care and well-being.
One thing that interested me is that if you look at the Enlightenment philosophers around the period of Tom Paine, Condorcet, and people like that, I mean, they were very impressed by the prospect that medicine would enable people to live longer, happier lives. But they thought that that had to take place in a context of social reform. That is, that you'd need to redistribute resources in order to allow people to live longer, better lives. And basically, I mean, that's, I mean, apart from the irony and the pessimistic stuff, I mean, the point of my talk is to say that you can't have longevity without social reform. And my pessimism is driven by the fact that in America and much of Europe, that the short-term view of cutbacks doesn't seem to me to be supporting the idea that people could or should live longer, happier lives with better resources, and that the short-termism of cutting back on health and education is not going to sustain the kind of meaningful and enjoyable lives that you want to have. And I'm sort of worried, I'm worried that that what one sees in America is being exported here, which is huge inequalities within society between the rich and the poor, so that the elderly get marginalised, particularly where they don't have adequate pensions and so on and so forth. So I don't think we're necessarily disagreeing. I'm saying that I'm pessimistic because I don't see social policies in Northern Europe or America that's going to make possible the enjoyment of longer lives.
I think now we'll have our short break.
We'll
take a 10-minute break.